Friday, August 25th. Began early. Coffee with Lyndon about 7:15. The last packing. Goodbyes. And out at Dulles over the beautiful George Washington Memorial Parkway. But Saarinen's great building was swathed in fog, and I began to wonder what would happen to our plane. Sure enough, it didn't fly, and there we sat for almost 3 hours, with a new departure time announced every 15 minutes, and finally the plane canceled, and then a decision to wait for the one that left at 12:15. I used the time in a little office to make telephone calls and work on the contents of my ubiquitous straw basket. Dale was waiting for me in Dallas, and we flew on to Austin. My work time at the ranch had been canceled out by the long wait. So, instead, I had a pleasant hour and a half at Lucy's. The gold coach and the ball gown have disappeared, and Cinderella is indeed back by the fireside. For the first time, really, Lucy is finding out what it's like to wash the diapers and fix the formula, and put supper on the table and clean the house. And if things had been done with a lick and a promise here and there, as Aunt Effie would have said, the major ingredients were very much present. A joyous, laughing household. Lynn weighs 14 pounds and an ounce, and he's getting hard to hold. He practically wants to stand up in your arms. A little past 5, I drove over to Salada for the ceremony placing the historical marker on the old Sterling Robertson home, Liz's birthplace, and dedicating another historical marker to Liz and her career. And with these had been combined an exhibit of Texas crafts. A crowd that the paper estimated at 5,000 was gathered in the grounds of the old house. Liz's aunt, Mrs. Robertson, was at the gate to meet me. We walked down the long alleyway between the arborvitae, the 12 of them representing the 12 apostles, a custom in old Southern homes. Nellie Connolly had driven up right behind me. How I wish we'd had the trip together. And we took our seats on the front porch, which served as the stage, along with John Ben Shepherd and Liz, and Congressman Bob Pogue, and officials of the Texas Historical Foundation and the Federation of Women's Clubs, and the Historical Survey Committee, and the Museum Association. What a burgeoning interest this is becoming in my part of the country. John Ben presided. He's the catalyst in so much of the historic preservation, conservation, art-related fields in Texas. And then there were brief talks about all the facets of the program, replacing official markers, the Outstanding Women of Texas series, a warm and colorful history of the old house itself. By Mrs. Robinson, one of the interesting things to me is that there's a room on the front porch that was called the Stranger's Room, and it was there available for whoever came to spend the night, and there was no thought of fear or harm. It was pioneer hospitality. So much for the house, and then we got to Liz. Jerry Vanderhavel, the president of the Women's National Press Club, gave an hilarious little talk on Liz Carpenter, Washington journalist, followed by DeWitt Reddick on Liz Carpenter, Texan, and ended with a very few words impromptu by me that could have been called Liz Carpenter, can-do woman. Liz's speech was excellent, leavened with humor, but full of solid meat about today's world. Her springboard, of course, yesterday's history and how it applies to the problems we face today. She said, and this is where my thoughts went homing in, it'll be so much easier for the president not to concern himself with stopping communism on the other side of the globe. It would be so much easier for Mrs. Johnson not to take all these trips in the interest of beautification and conservation. That easier approach has a rainbow appeal. It was a short ceremony, and then Nellie, looking so young and sprightly, cut the ribbon opening the craft show. And I began going around on the big lawn, from wood carving booth to sketching to spinning. There was a 90-year-old lady from the delightful town of Mountain Home who used a 200-year-old spinning wheel. The stitchery booths, absolutely beautiful, some of them were. And Jeanette Shook's needlepoint was a real dream. There were ceramics and pottery. And one booth used the cores from oil wells to make bookends and lamp bases. I could hardly take 5 steps without some little freckle-faced child putting in front of me a grubby piece of paper and a stubby pencil, saying, "May I have your autograph, please?" For almost the first time, I got provoked at it because I either had my choice of seeing the craft show or doing the autograph. And I hope I held on to my serenity as I quickly gave him an LBJ and a smile and went on to see the next booth. My respect grew as I walked. There was much that was highly creative, in excellent taste, and it was genuine, truly of this soil and this history. the road runner on the sign, the gnarled mesquite root used as a centerpiece, the little ceramic figures of an owl or quail. Sometimes taste and creativity and market appeal were marvelously combined, as in Janet Shook's Needlepoint. And sometimes, oh, unhappily not. My progress across the lawn was broken by shrieks of greeting, hugs, and a quick exchange as I saw Bobby Dixon, a Terrell Maverick Webb, or the editor of the Gilman newspaper, a Roland Boyd from McKinney, and there was the oft-repeated, "Tell the president we're praying for him. How's LBJ? Give him our love. We hope he has a happy birthday. You tell him I've been voting for him since 1937. So many interesting things happened to me in a crowd. There was one moment of frozen pain when I found myself face to face with a young woman who reached out to shake my hand. Her face was appealing but strained. She said, haltingly, it was hard for her to get it out, "Mrs. Johnson, tell the president my husband is missing in Vietnam, but we believe in him." Suddenly, we were like two frozen statues all alone in the yard while I groped for something to say to her. Raw and impotent at this closeness to grief, I said, "Then I'll just return what people have been saying to me all afternoon. I'll pray for your husband." I walked on, and there was Jessie Hunter with her wildflower seed booth. And who but Flora Rita Schreiber, who has been following my footsteps all over Texas. I fear to pick up her story. And then a bittersweet moment when Marcia stopped me in front of the last booth, and there was just about the strangest concoction of all. It was a picture frame about 30 inches square, and in it was an old bird's nest, a dirt diamond nest, a cocoon from which some little creature had long ago crawled, a fossilized shell, a wasp nest, all put together in a sort of collage, and for good measure, a horned toad. There were wood carvings of birds and leather items, and all of a sudden, the nice-looking couple who presided over the booth picked up the strange concoction and said to me, "It's called home for someone. You see, everything in here has been home for something, except the horned toad, and if you have just the right place, we'd like to give it to you." This is a problem that happens over and over in public life, and I still do not know the right, kind, wise answer. Sometime back, I started making a little resolve that I would not accept things for the White House or the library or ourselves that I really couldn't use. And so I began to babble what I hoped sounded convincing, that it was so very artistic and it would be just right for some little boy's room or the den in somebody's home who was a naturalist or a scientist, but I just didn't think I had the right place to show it off. And meanwhile, the man was saying something like, "We just wanted you to have it if you had the right place," and a look of fading hope was going over the woman's face, and I felt like a dog. Repeating my thanks, I walked on, but all evening tasted the feeling of cruelty, of rebuff, and wondered what I should have done. I'd been fighting for the last 10 minutes of daylight to go to the cemetery to see the gravesite of George Washington Bayne, Lyndon's great-grandfather, and there was just about that 10 minutes left when I got in the car with Paul and Virginia Kennison, he's Lyndon's first cousin, and we drove to the cemetery and got out and walked, and presently, behind a neat little wrought iron fence, there it was, a shaft of stone about as high as a man. I think there must have been an angel on top of it once, and the brief legend of his life, and two smaller grave markers, nicely kept and very impressive. Virginia had been going around with me quietly, and then she said, "If you would like to stop by my house, I have something I want to give you for Lyndon's birthplace home. She has an antique shop, and her house, too, has one of the historical markers. Salida is an old, old Texas town with more than its share of charm and history. And together with the legendary Stagecoach Inn, they have combined to give it a economic renaissance, a picturesque but modern motor court along its clear river, beautifully landscaped." Virginia brought out of a cupboard, carefully wrapped, an old sugar bowl, part of a silver service that Mr. Johnson had given Mrs. Johnson when they married in 1907. So she told me. She did not know what had happened to the coffee pot or cream pitcher. She told of the habit of Mr. Johnson, who every time any of the kinfolks came for a visit, always wanted to give them something when they left, and of how one time he couldn't find a thing to give them except a sack of onions. And then she showed me two hats that had belonged to Mrs. Johnson. One of them I remembered, an elegant, beautiful hat which Lyndon had bought for his mother when she visited us in the 40s. I think Linda must have been 1 or 2 years old. It was a sort of a mauve pink. He'd bought the hat and the suit as a Mother's Day present, and I'd spent all day with her shopping to select it. And she'd really looked queenly. The other was even older. It had been redecorated by Aunt Josepha, who always had that feminine touch with clothes that Mrs. Johnson set little store in. I accepted all three gifts with gratitude. Someday they'll have a place either in the birthplace house or the family portion of the library. And then I went back by the Robinson house because I had not had a really proper thank you and goodbye to Mrs. Robinson. And also I wanted to take a second look at some of the things if they were there. I kept on remembering little drawings of wildlife, quail, an owl, a raccoon, by an art professor at Trinity University. Inside, the party was just breaking up, but there was just time for me to have a drink and a little visit with Nancy Negley and the Cattos and another look at the paintings. I bought one, the blue-crested quail. It will be Lyndon's birthday present, and I'll hang it in his new bath. Woody, whom I'd seen hours earlier when I changed planes in Dallas, had invited all of the exhibitors and the principals in the program, and I expect everybody that was left over, to come to a reception and buffet at Stagecoach Inn. But it had been a long day, and I didn't think I had that much vitality left. So I congratulated Liz and told everybody how wonderful I thought the whole program had been, especially the craft show. And then was on my way to the ranch with a brief stop at Bertram to get a hamburger, which I ate in the car. And it was after 11 when we arrived at the ranch, and so to bed.